we did some work trying to renovate the term. Because in our culture, the word humility has come to mean something very different than it did in the ancient understanding. And we saw that humility, when understood in these spiritual terms, is in fact a pathway to freedom. It's an invitation to live in reality as reality is. And reality is that the universe does not rotate around the axis of self. And when we act as though it does, when our instincts kick in as though the universe does rotate around the axis of me, then we do ourselves a great disservice. We carry a great deal of inordinate, unnecessary stress. So it turns out that we don't expand ourselves when we believe that the universe rotates around me. In fact, we end up reducing ourselves. We end up stressing ourselves. We carry burdens that we cannot, in fact, carry. We prop up lives that we cannot, in fact, live. So, humility, properly understood, we said in that first lesson, is this ancient pathway to freedom, peace, and interior rest. Free from the clutching and free from the striving and free from the driving and free from the fear that drives so much of life, we find that humility is a pathway to freedom. It is not, we saw, thinking less of ourselves. It's actually thinking just less about ourselves. It is living without our lives being propped up by the need to manage our image, to manage the interior responses, to think about how this affects me, and to be able to do, and to be able to be, and to be able to give, and to be able to contribute in the simple context of just being myself. Absent the pressure of me, my, and mine being the pressing concern in every context, how this affects me, what I do, when that's absent, we are able to simply live from our authentic selves. So humility, we saw, is freedom, because humility is truth, and truth, Jesus taught us, sets us free. So after that first lesson, I turned to applying the concept to our lives. What happens when we live humbly? And the first application we look at was how our God so often bores us. When we position ourselves at the center of everything, again, it doesn't turn out that that makes us grander. It doesn't become real just because we position ourselves that way. We find that we simply have to carry it all. And when we position ourselves having to carry it all, then we are obligated to carry it all. And being at the center compels us to do so. And one of the things that happens regularly in religious life is that we become responsible for everything, so we have to shrink everything down to a size we can actually carry. And one of the things that we do is shrink God down to a size that we can actually carry, because we are responsible to figure this God thing out, because we are responsible for it all. It's our duty to figure God out and then configure our lives to fit into the way God is. We have to figure out what God is like. We have to figure out what God wants. We have to figure out how God organized the universe. And then we have to get on board with the program and make sure that things work out for us. And so Christian people, like so many of other religious people, do a great deal of work trying to define God. God is this way. God is not that way. God does this. God does not do that. And after all that work that we've done defining the indefinable God, we're stuck with a God that we've reduced down to fit inside of our heads, this reduced little doctrine God that will fit in our theology books, this reduced little creed God that will fit in our traditions. And this reduced God that is really nothing much more than a totem that we are able to carry, because remember, unhumble people have to carry it all. This God that we can imagine, it turns out, isn't worthy of our lives. This God that we can imagine isn't worthy of our passions or our energies. This God that we can reduce down to carry in our minds isn't worthy of our desires, of the deep abiding thirsts of our soul, and of the zeal that we have to give to life. Because any God that we can reduce to a small enough package that we can carry bores us. So, we concluded, when we apply humility to our daily lives, we become people re-steeped in wonder. We become people restored to awe. We re-enter the childlike world of amazement, wonderment. We begin to find apathy being stripped away, and we become astonished again. We are moved to worship that which is truly beyond us. We are reawakened to a bigger reality. We are drawn back to the heart of our religion, the awe and grandeur, because we no longer have to reduce experience down to the small box that we can carry. Humble people challenge boredom in their lives. Humble people resist apathy. Humble people are able to rise above indifference and are able to transcend the languor that so often wears us down when we have to carry everything. When we have to carry God in our pockets, we have to carry God in our doctrines. So those are the first two lessons we did around this theme of humility. And since there was Easter and then there was a break after Easter where I had George speak, that we've had a longer break than normal. So now I want to turn to the second and as yet unnamed application of the virtue of humility in our daily lives. I'll give you the word that defines this application in a moment. Actually, it'll be at the very end. When you hear the verse, when you hear the word, you'll know we're done. But like the word humility, this word has some baggage associated with it. It's an ancient practice that is based in an ancient truth. It has a powerful dynamic and it transforms our spiritual lives. It does wonders in our everyday living. But for so many, because it has been abused and because it has been misused and because it has been ritualized, it has lost its meaning and it's become an archaic term, an old-fashioned and often considered irrelevant idea. So I'm not going to use the word right away because I don't want to elicit the defense mechanisms in your heads. So instead, we're going to ease into it. By the time you actually hear the word, you are all going to agree with me that this is a great idea and a wonderful way. This is how we should live our lives. But first, for those of you who were here in 2009, a little bit of review about the human condition. The slides I'm going to show you are from a lesson that we did together in 2009 titled The Practice of Soul Tending. And these particular slides talk about the context of the human condition, and we're going to look at this context because it applies to this application of humility as well. But it'll be review for some who've heard this once before. Using the Genesis story as a starting place for thinking about our humanity, this helps us name our experience because you wake up inside of yourself, just like I have awakened inside of myself, and you find certain characteristics that are true of what you discover about you. And the story tells us this, that you are created in the likeness of God, that you are created in the very image of God, that you carry within you a divine center, that yes, your body is made of stardust, but there is some other part of you that is made out of God dust, that there is within you the indwelling presence of the Spirit of God, that you are animated by the breath of God. The story tells us that there is something inside of you that is of God, that is in God, that is by God. But it also talks about this secondary nature you also find in yourself. The story uses the term a fallen nature or a corrupted nature. So we human beings awaken to self-consciousness relatively early in our lives, and we look inside and we see these two realities about ourselves. We have a divine center made in the image of God nature, a virtuous nature, a noble nature, a principled nature. You have that inside of you. A moral part of you, a very decent part of you, a self-sacrificing part of you, a righteous part of you. But you also, when you look inside of yourself, see that there's something else there as well that is not quite so virtuous. This is an ignoble nature. It is more base. It is capable of quite dastardly words and quite dastardly deeds. It is a lower, seemingly corrupted, sometimes immoral side of you. And it is as dishonorable as the other side is honorable. It is as selfish as the other side is selfless. It is as unrighteous as the other part is righteous. And that's the human dilemma described in our creation story at the very beginning, made in the image of God, carrying a lesser image as well. And seeing this at the early age that we do when we awaken to consciousness and look inside of ourselves, it is a universal human response to feel bad about that. Something is wrong. I am this, but so often I am that. And we think there's something wrong. And being young as we are when we come to self-consciousness, though we are not still one with the universe, we have differentiated some, we still think that the universe rotates around us. And so when blame is to be laid for this problem that seems to be going on inside of us, it is an almost a universal human characteristic to lay blame here. Something is wrong, and that something that is wrong is me. And so part of the human condition is to have this interior sense that there is something wrong with me. This is not guilt over some bad act that I have committed. This is not guilt over some bad word that I have said or some bad deed that I have done. No, this is a sense that at my core, there is something fundamentally wrong with me. A fundamental belief that I am not good, that I am not worthy, that I am not luminous, that I am not marvelous. I am rather bad or unworthy, vile, perhaps even contemptible. Now, this reality we're calling existential shame, this is an intolerable reality. You can't live with that thing running around inside of you. You can't get up in the morning, you can't make your coffee, you can't tie your shoes, you can't make babies and raise children, you can't get a job, you can't finish school, you can't do any of that stuff that requires your bandwidth if shame is given its unfettered way inside of you, because shame is such a disruptive reality inside of us. You've got to do something about that. It will overrun you. It will destroy your interior world. It is so toxic, it has to be dealt with. And so, we do what human beings have done from the very beginning. When faced with this interior sense of something bad wrong with me, we cope. In order to cope, we develop certain coping strategies. Now, these strategies that we develop are as varied as there are people among us, but there's some very common themes in how it is that we cope with these problems, with this interior shame problem. And one of the most common things that we do is that we grab something that we're good at, and we pin our worth on being good at that thing. We grab something that we are able to do well, and we pin our value on being able to do that thing well. We pin our goodness on that, on our ability to do this thing well, to be good at it, to do something that distinguishes us. So if we're smart, or if we're compassionate, or if we're good at leading other people, or if we are attractive, we grab that thing that we're good at, and we pin our hopes on it. If I can be nice to people such that people like me, if I can be attractive enough that people will admire me, if I can be smart enough that I can make life work out for me, if I've got a knack for this or a knack for that and it makes me stand out, it distinguishes me from other people, well, that must prove that I am okay. And that must prove that that universal sense of shame that I was feeling down there inside of me, that must have been wrong. I'm okay. Whew, what a relief. And I can take that sense of shame and I can bury it so many layers down that I don't even have to think about it. It doesn't even come on the scope of my consciousness. I'm not even aware that it's going on. It's just sitting down there locked up in a cage, stuffed under the bed somewhere where I don't have to think about it. And I can get on with the business of life. I can go to school, I can get a job, I can raise babies, I can move forward in life. Phew, I'm okay. And to be truthful, this is our salvation. Saved from shame is being saved from destruction, because shame will destroy us. So it is true. However, when we pin our identity, when we pin our very self, when we pin our very nature, our being, on something that we're good at, it's not really a true. It's a short-term solution to a really bad problem. It's just not true. Because being good at something is not a big enough container to hold our self. You are not your beauty. And you are not your intelligence. And you are not your compassion. And you are not your work ethic. You are not your knack for managing money. You're not your talent for getting along with people. You're not your talent for getting other people to like you. These are gifts that you have, but they do help you overcome this sense of shame that would like to overrun you, but they're not enough. They're not a big enough reality to contain the essence of self. And when we make these gifts that we have into identities, when we turn these things that we are capable at into a very self, when we pin our hopes on them for being, it lets us down. Bad things go wrong. When we make a gift into an identity, we put a tremendous amount of pressure on that gift. Whereas when it's simply a gift, I give that gift when it needs to be given. The world needs beauty. We are attracted to beauty. And if you have beauty to give, you can give it when it is needed. The world needs intelligence because we've got problems that need to be solved. And if you have intelligence, you can offer that intelligence and solve some problems. The world needs people who can lead because some people lead and some people don't do that as well. And so if you've got that gift, when it's needed, you can give it. But once you have turned those gifts into an identity, then it's no longer that the world needs that gift of you. Now it's that you need to be giving it. Because you're giving it in order to prop up a sense of self. You've got a strategic interest in being able to give that gift. Because you're using it as a tool to keep your shame monster pinned up and locked in the attic or the basement. I need to be compassionate. I need to be being kind. I need to be being understanding because this is what's making me a good person and I need to be a good person. I need to be leading. I need to be beautiful. I need to be problem solving. I need to be doing well at money managing. I need to be doing a good job at getting the work done because this is making me a good person, and I need to be a good person in order to keep that existential shame locked away. And if I don't have a strategy for making me okay, well, then I'm in trouble. And sure enough, when we turn gifts into identities, they actually become vices. Because when we have to be giving that gift, compassion and kindness becomes a desperate need to be needed. Understanding and niceness becomes people-pleasing. Intelligence and problem-solving becomes arrogance and the desperate need to be right all the time. Beauty becomes vanity. Money managing becomes control. Leadership becomes domination, and so forth. Now, if we had more time, I would expand this section a little bit further, but let me just hit the highlights. As we walk down the Christian journey, what we discover over time is that salvation becomes less about getting our ways into heaven, and it becomes more about solving this fundamental human dilemma. Becomes more about this essential element of life that dismantles the illusion that the dark side of us defines us. As we walk down the spiritual journey, practicing the ancient spiritual practices, what happens over time is we stop believing that I am my sin. And we start believing that I am made in the very likeness of God. That I am animated by the very breath of God. You hear it many times here. You sin, yes, you do, we all do. But you are not your sin. The sin, we are learning, is a veneer, and the divine center is the essential nature. It was there first, our story tells us. It was breathed into us from the beginning, our story tells us. It is what animates us. It is what makes us us. And nothing, not even sin, not eating the apple, not the fall, not the distorted doctrine of original sin, not the skewed belief that we are totally depraved and unworthy of God, none of these historical distortions undercut the truth that you are made in the image of God, that you are made in the likeness of God, that you are filled with the Spirit of God, that the mysterious essence that is the divine is what makes us us. And so at NRCC, we scandalize people from time to time, and I just learned recently that we get some hate mail about this that I have been spared of. And when we say on our statement of faith that sin is not that big a deal, it really gets good Christian people upset. It's not that it's not a deal, as we'll see in a moment, it's that it's not that big a deal. It's not big enough to define you. It's not big enough to be an identity for you. It's not big enough to be your naming reality. But that doesn't mean that you don't sin, and that doesn't mean that sin's not a problem. It just means that it doesn't define you. Sin will hurt you, cause you a great deal of pain. It will hurt you, and it will hurt the people that you love. It will do great damage to the society of which you are a part, to the community that you impact each every day. Sin sucks. It's bad. It's really, really bad. Harsh, hurtful words wound us, and they wound others. Disrespecting our bodies makes us sick. Disregarding the wisdom of our sexuality breaks relationships. Disregarding justice for all makes our society fragile, makes our community hurt. Sin is bad, really, really bad. It's just not your identity. It's the toxic byproduct of a coping strategy that you chose to survive your existential shame, and it is a veneer on your identity, a really painful veneer, but a veneer. Now, for us today, the question is, what do we do about sin? Well, the first thing that we do about sin is we don't define ourselves with it. We don't make it the identifying characteristic of our being. But that doesn't mean that we don't have to deal with it. So all of that background that I gave you from that 2009 lesson now comes to this context. What do we do about the human condition? What do we do about this reality? So yes, it doesn't define us. It is not who we are, but it doesn't not bother us either. It will affect our lives profoundly. So again, let me review for you this part. When we come to humility, we are deluded. When we lack humility, we are deluded into believing that we have to carry it all, including these homemade identities that we have made. We believe we have to prop them up, and we believe we have to contain them. We believe we have to make them keep working for us, because we believe it is up to us to keep that shame monster locked up and keep ourselves unaware of it. We believe that's all up to me. And so I have to guard carefully these strategies that I have developed over time. I've got to guard carefully all of these ways that I have chosen to live. Lost humility demands that I do this. As a result of that, one of the byproducts is lost humility compels me to look away from my weakness. What it does not do when I lose humility is take me by the hand and walk me gently and caringly over to look at my weakness. Lost humility has to function this way. Remember, we're responsible to carry this whole thing, and if we let our guard down, we believe we will let the shame monster out, and our survival is at risk, and we have to prop this thing up. So we do well not to look at our failures. We do well not to look at our weakness. We do well to have these clever psycho-emotional strategies that cause us to just block that part out and whistle while we walk by them so that we don't have to be frightened by them. At least that's what most human beings have configured life to believe. So what do we do about sin? We talk about it with a spiritual friend. So I'm going to introduce this lesson on humility with a story, and then we'll be done. I have several friends, spiritual friends in my life, and I talk about my soul with these people. To the degree that I am aware of darkness that's going on inside of me, I have always tried really hard to talk to somebody about it. I'm 54 years old now, and so those of you who are not yet into your 50s, you perhaps need to know something that happens when you cross over 50, and it is this. At 50, you stop counting how many years you have, and you start counting how many years you have left. We start assessing life and say, in the years that I have left, is this the life that I want? Have my choices heretofore gotten me to a place that I want to be? And like so many people who cross that threshold, I've done that. And in so many ways, I've had a lovely life. I'm very fulfilled. But for the last 2 years, maybe 1 year, I've been really unhappy with Denise. Now, you're going to have to bear with me because she's going to end up looking really good at the end. And I don't want your protect Denise instincts to kick in and keep you from hearing the story, all right? So just know, in the end, she's going to look great. So, I have felt uncherished, uncared for, devalued, deprioritized in the shuffle of things that happen in life. And I've been asking myself as I cross this 50-year barrier, is this the life that I want? And was determining, no, I don't think so. And I had grown quietly resentful inside, and I have in many ways withdrawn from Denise, and I have been argumentative, and I have been sensitive, and I have been angry. I've been kind of a pain to live with. And you can hear me use words every Sunday, and you probably, like I, think I'm pretty good with words. So you can imagine what happens at home. I am the master with words, and I can use them to make it all look like it's her fault. I make the righteousness of my cause shine like the noonday sun. And in the midst of my dissatisfaction with this season of life assessment, I have sinned. I have spoken bitter words, condemning words, angry words, blaming words, hurtful words. I couldn't see the root of my sin. In fact, what I saw was that I had a really good case and I was making it. But again, it's been my habit to do something that I know a lot of people do not do. And that is the word that I'm not using. It's the ancient spiritual practice that I'm not naming yet. What I've tended to do is I've tended to talk about my weaknesses with my spiritual friends. So every time those blaming words came out, they went into a file in my head I knew I was going to need to talk with somebody about. Every time those angry words, every time those bitter words, every time those negative feelings came out, I knew that I would need to talk about them, and I have, over the course of these years, talked about them with quite a few people. Because it is my habit to tell people about my bad thoughts. It is my habit to tell people about my bad deeds. I talk to people when I misdirect my sexual energies. I talk to people when things come out of my mouth that shouldn't come out of my mouth. I talk about these things all the time. As a matter of fact, Lindsay, who's Vicky's daughter, she's dating a new guy, and so I went out with him the other day, and so I've never met him before, and so he asked me how I'm doing. And I happened to be in the middle of one of these things, so I just unloaded. I said, this is how I'm doing. His eyes got really big, and I said, that's probably more information than you wanted. And he said, no, I really did ask. So this issue with Denise has been plaguing me for many, many months. So this past Lent, I went without some of my favorite foods, and I spoke about this issue on several occasions with spiritual friends during the season of Lent. And I can tell you, it was not a happy Lent. It was a very dismal one. It was a very dark and angry time. And then 2 weeks ago, in several conversations, there seemed to conspire a configuration of comments that were made that I heard that I had not heard in a long time. And in this amalgamation of comments, I heard something like this, and I saw something about my life that went like this. I remember when Denise and I were first married, we lived in student housing in Pasadena, California, in this little tiny house. And house, it was a little tiny apartment with two rooms in it. And I remember being in that house and positioning myself even then to resist appearing weak in front of Denise. And all the years from then until now, I have resisted allowing her to see me be afraid. I have resisted allowing her to see me be anxious. I have resisted allowing her to see times when I was needy. I have projected an image of Doug to her that has been completely sufficient and completely capable. When it comes to her nurturing me, I have put up walls of resistance that she had to overcome if she wanted to nurture me, because I have positioned myself exclusively as the caregiver and not as the care receiver. I am the strong one. I am the invincible one. I am the unwaveringly reliable one. I am the rock. And so, in the early years of our relationship, she tried to break through this persona persistently. Through the years, she has tried to take care of me, and I have made comments that were very dismissive of her attempts. And then from time to time through those years, she has commented that if she were to die, I would do my duty and get her properly buried, but then I would just move on with life because, she said, you really don't need me. And I have acted that way. I have acted as though I do not need her. Try as she might, I have not budged. Now, why would I do that? I mean, I didn't know I was doing it. I have to assume now, in hindsight, looking back after these conversations that I've had with my spiritual friends, that it was somehow worth it to me to keep myself from being nurtured. And so what was I getting? What was the payoff that made this worthwhile? The payoff was that it was a clever strategy for keeping my shame monster penned up and out of my consciousness. I have a gift, and that is, I have a strong temperament. I do have a strong personality. I am a caregiving personality. It is not often that I do need to be nurtured. It's not never, but it's not often. So I had taken a gift and turned it into an identity, and it turns out that that gift-turned identity wasn't working all that well for me, because the very things that I have been resenting for the last many months of being uncherished and being unnurtured was a gift-turned identity that I was working for my own benefit. And Denise, over the years, just finally gave up, and she let me be the persona that I wanted to be. And even if it cost me being cared for, even if it cost me having an ally or having a supporter, for me, it must have been worth the price of admission. Because I got to keep believing about myself that I was powerful and invincible, that I was sufficient and unneedy, and that I was strong. Now, it turns out, I guess I wasn't as much as I thought. But I had taken something that I was good at, turned it into an identity, and slowly poisoned myself over time. So, I told you Denise was going to look good in this story, and here's how that happens. I obviously have talked this over with her. And here's what she didn't do. When I told her all of this stuff, she didn't say, "I told you so, you idiot." Instead, what she did was she immediately went to work trying to figure out how it was that I did need to be cared for. That's not the point. That's just the tip of my hat to her wonderfulness. The point is, I was locked in a system that I couldn't see. I don't like being unhappy. I don't like being miserable. I don't like being resentful. I'd have gotten out of this thing a long time ago if I could have seen it. If I could have told you what the problem was, I would have been out of the problem years ago. I was suffocating myself under a load that I couldn't define. All I knew was that I was just doing this thing. But I have spiritual friends, and I talk about things with my spiritual friends. And as I've talked about the dark times, I kept honing in, being able to strip off a layer. Why was I saying these awful things? Why was I having these kinds of thoughts? And step by step by step, I was able to strip away layer after layer until the time came when the moment was right and I could see what I had never previously seen in all those years. And so here's the word. This is what this lesson is about. It is the ancient spiritual discipline of confession. And here's our text for this morning. Confess your sins one to another that you may be healed. Confess your sins one to another that you may be healed. Today's an introduction. I'll spend a few weeks on this trait. I'm going to talk to you about how to make a confession. I'm going to talk to you about how to receive a confession. I'm going to talk to you about the practicalities of the confession. But today I want you to hear, why in the world would you do this? And what I want you to hear is this. Humble people don't define themselves as their sin. You cannot contain self in a package that you can imagine. You can't create a homemade self that will be sufficient. You cannot pin your hopes on what you can do well. That's not a big enough identity to contain you. So consequently, humble people do not define themselves as their sin. Humble people do not reduce themselves down to a size they can carry. So consequently, not defining themselves that narrowly, they don't have to look away from their sin in order to protect their shame-distracting self-image. Humble people can afford to be curious about their sin, to look at it instead of looking away from it. Humble people can afford to talk about their lives and their weaknesses and their shortcomings and their failures with trusted friends. Humble people can find freedom from their shortcomings, from their sin, a whole lot faster than they otherwise would have because they feel safe enough to be able to talk about it. And so as you hear this lesson, my encouragement to you today is to make this application of humility to your life. Look at the dark parts of your life. Talk about them with other people. What do humble people do about their sin? They talk about it with trusted friends. And so, Lord, I pray for us as a community of individuals and for us as a collective entity, that we would develop the trust necessary, the courage necessary to step away from the old coping strategies, from the old ways of keeping those parts of us hidden away so we don't have to look at them, and we would do just the opposite. We would look at our weaknesses. We would come to the place where we walk through them to the other side rather than backing away from them and leaving them down there to dominate and control our days. May we be a courageous people, a trusting people, a safe people, a humble people, a confessing people. In Jesus' name, amen.